There's something about spring that just feels like a reset. Longer days, fresh energy, and the motivation to try something new. This spring, that something new could be learning a new language. That's where Rosetta Stone comes in. They've been a leader in language learning for over 30 years with an immersive method that helps you learn naturally, connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context instead of memorizing or translating. With over 25 languages to choose from, like Spanish, French, German, even Japanese, Rosetta Stone is a go-to tool for real language learning. It's designed to help you think in your new language so what you learn actually sticks. Plus, True Accent gives real-time feedback on your pronunciation so you sound more natural, like having a personal coach. And you can learn anytime, anywhere, whether you've got 5 minutes or a full hour. Ready to start learning a new language this spring? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
I'm a part of the Bronx 120. That's the group that was indicted in 2016, the largest gang raid in New York City history. And we're bringing light to the injustices of what happened, because on the news, it was just all about the biggest raid, the 120 gang members, but they never really brought to the light the people that were doing, the good people that got caught in the raid, that went down as collateral damage. And that's me and my story, and I have a couple friends that's just like that too.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Preet Bharara, and I'm the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Today we announce what is believed to be the largest gang takedown in New York City history.
They put on the news 120 gang members.
We have charged 120 defendants in two rival Bronx street gangs.
50, 60 people weren't gang members. They were actually like civilians. So on the news it says 120 gang members. What you really just took the community.
Right.
That's what you should have put. We swept through the uptown Bronx community. We swept. You didn't sweep 120 gang members because they weren't gang members.
Right.
So why are they in the feds?
The charges include allegations of racketeering, narcotics, and firearms offenses. Multiple murders, attempted murders, shootings, stabbings, and beatings.
Like majority copped out to marijuana charge. Like that is wrong. Like they shouldn't be in the federal penitentiary.
Nearly 700 NYPD officers and federal agents swept through the city to make arrests and to conduct court-authorized searches.
And you're promoting that you're cleaning up the streets of gang members, but you're really not.
So why did we bring these charges and take these actions today? The answer is very simple.
You're just destroying our youth. The average ages were like 25. Like, I mean, I got someone that just turned 18 and now he's in the feds. And you can't tell me what he did.
Welcome to the Katie Halper Show. I speak to Craig Lewis, rapper, former MBA student, and one of the 120 Black and Latino young men rounded up and prosecuted under RICO conspiracy charges. So the Bronx 120 raid happened 3 years ago, but it's back in the news because a report on it just came out. The authors of the report, Babe Howell, a CUNY law professor, and Priscilla Bustamante, a doctoral student at the CUNY Graduate Center, found...
I'll let Priscilla tell you.
More than half of the Bronx 120 were not affirmatively alleged to be members of either rival gang. Only 56 individuals, less than half of all the defendants, were alleged to be members of a gang or crew. 34 people were not members. 17 people were labeled as associates of or associated with a gang. The prosecution makes clear that defendants who are gang associates are not gang members, which brings the total of non-gang members to 51 people.
Two-thirds were not convicted based on conduct that was alleged to be violent. For half of them, we're talking drug sales, and 35 of them were marijuana sales.
A really disturbing aspect of this is how social media posts and texts were used.
We obtained warrants for over 100 Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram accounts connected to the defendant's alleged criminal activity.
Our Bronx Gang Squad investigators have been meticulous in identifying the main suspects, getting access to their conversations, and strategically buying their poison. These gang members do not belong on our streets. Instead, they belong exactly where they are going, to federal prison for many years, where they won't be surrounded by their buddies, they won't be close to their families, and they'll no longer be free to terrorize the neighborhoods in which they grew up.
Craig Lewis pled to conspiracy to distribute narcotics, and in his case, it was weed. I also talked to Alex Vitale, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the author of their really great book, The End of Policing. Both Alex and Craig are part of a network of researchers and advocates working to end large gang conspiracy cases, to chat with both of them. Stand by for the Patreon-only episode I'm releasing, which is a chat with The Intercept's criminal justice reporter Alice Sperry, who wrote about the Bronx 120, as well as the FBI's fictional Black identity extremism movement. To do that, go to patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. So talk about what happened to you in 2016. You weren't even in the Bronx at this point.
I was in grad school at University of Bridgeport. I had one more semester to graduate. I was getting my MBA, my master's in business and administration. The day they raided my house, I was preparing for a statistics final. All night, I actually had my son with me up there. He was on his little week break. And I was taking him to the classes with me. I have no babysitter. I had a girlfriend that was watching him at the time.
How old was he at the time?
He was six at the time. And they came in there and showed me the warrant. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was like a joke or something. And then I was actually, because I got my bachelor's in criminal justice and I knew the law, I really felt like, okay, I'm going to beat this or I'm going to get bail so I could come back and finish school, get my master's or whatever. But federal law, it wasn't happening. They labeled me a menace to society. At my arraignment, they were saying that I got shot and I was trying to shoot people and I'm Nicky Barnes, but I never got shot before. So that's just to show you what I was dealing with. None of that, a majority of the things they said at my arraignment wasn't even true, and they still just was attacking me and took away my bail. Mother crying, it was really bad. So, I went in there with my head high. After a couple months, I lost my hope. I was trying not to give up. I turned to God and I reached out. A few protesters and stuff reached out to me. And through that, we were able to create a documentary, which we tell the whole story of what happened to me.
It's called Trouble Finds You.
You can find it on YouTube.
You were in jail for how long? And can you talk about
months,
your experience
2 years.
There?
It was a time where I could get to know myself better, who I really am. How can I handle pressure? How can I overcome the worst situation ever? Can you even imagine? That's what I'm taking out of it.
Right.
At this point in my life, it was a rough time. But I was the last time I got to spend with my friends that I grew up with since I was 10, 9. And I really love them dudes, those are really like my brothers, without blood. So, I was there with the knowledge to read the law, read the case law, read the study my law, help my friends with their cases, the ones that were around me. It was a gang thing that was going on because we Black and we're together and we know each other. Now we're from New York, so it was rough going against other people in there, just trying to survive. Remember, I was up in school. I had never been in jail. I learned a lot. I read more books than I did in school. All my downtime, I was reading books the whole night, throughout the night. I try to sleep in the day and try to read in the night. I adapted quickly.
You got out of jail early. You only did 22 months.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I did 20. Did
and then the
years.
Judge threw out the sentence?
Yeah, he threw out the 5-year plea. And that I knew they would have to come with something else. They would have to come with another plea. I done studied all the charges they could have possibly gave me. Once he came with the marijuana plea, even though I ain't sell all that, I didn't do it. I knew I did more time than I was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime I get back in front of that judge, he gonna let me go home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was hoping.
Yeah.
I ain't know nothing. Right. Dealing with them, you don't know nothing.
Right.
So that's what happened. I went to cop out to my new plea, and he let me out on bail. And that's how I came home. But
the obstacle
I face now is ridiculous. Like, it's crazy. Me personally, I went to Mount St. Michael.
It's a Catholic
school. It's a Catholic school. It's like just top five in the Bronx. All boys school. My summer schools, I went to public school. So I knew the difference.
Mm.
I knew the difference, and I had friends in public school. But my school was like Hogwarts.
Harry Potter reference.
Yeah.
Welcome to Hogwarts. Your triumphs will earn you points. Any rule breaking and you will lose points.
I learned and I excelled. I was doing great, but I was still hanging out with my friends. I was able to go to school, and I'm planning, like, I'm going to do this criminal justice thing because all my friends keep getting locked up. I was chasing the dream to become a lawyer. I went for my MBA. So I could learn the business, so I could build a law firm in Gun Hill to help my friends, because all of them were in and out of jail.
Right.
And it's a lot of them, over 50 of them, in and out of jail. I figured, okay, become a lawyer, I'll be able to represent all these people. I'll be a millionaire.
Right.
No time.
Right.
So
class action suits, especially, right?
And, like, me having that mentality, I would never, ever, ever go back and do construction for minimum wage. Like, I would have been anywhere interning for minimum wage to start. I interned at a law firm
in
2013. I got a felony now, and now I'm back.
You're a very good example of how the whole narrative around gang members is so ridiculous and absurd, and you really shatter a lot of stereotypes.
It's not right.
But just like not everyone has your experience, right? A lot of people weren't getting their MBAs, and you shouldn't have to be getting your MBA to be immune from this stuff. And you weren't immune because you actually went to jail. But was your experience in jail different from people? Like, you were able to, I guess the silver lining is that you were able to kind of, because we had Tiffany Caban, another person who was really great. She's running for Queens DA. And she's one of these people who's running for the DA who comes from the other side, like a public defender like Larry Krasner. And they're kind of infiltrating the system, right? And she talks about, like, trauma-based justice. I mean, it's, like, not something you usually hear about from a DA perspective. But one of the people called in and said how when he was in jail, he was able to kind of be very introspective and learn a lot, kind of like what you were saying. Yeah. And of course, you shouldn't have to go to jail to do that, right?
Yeah.
Like, people should be able to do that through education or while they're free, you know, not while they're behind bars. And most people don't do that. As we know, people who are released, they don't, you know, have these kind of eureka moments. Education intensive. Yeah, positive transformations.
In my case, like, the week I was going to jail, I had a Stop the Violence campaign. My Stop the Violence event was the 29th, where I went around to elementary schools in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and told them to, like, yo, come to the college for this game. I got DJ Self from Love & Hip Hop and Hot 97 coming. A dunk contest from my member. I was on the team, the basketball team. I was just make my players go crazy. I was coaching at the time. I set up a tournament, dancers. Like, I was giving back. I got indicted on the 26th. My event was the 29th, so my girlfriend at the time had to run it. So that time I was in there, I just wasn't trying to lose who I really was. Like, so when I came out, I just got back to doing that. I just did it back in the Bronx. So I took what I learned in college and just applied it in the neighborhood. My first big give back, where I gave back 1,000 bags with DJ Drewski from Hot 97 in ECG, East Chester Gardens, where the raid happened. So they never really seen nothing like that. Like, the celebrities coming through to try to help them. Like, and I'm going to just keep doing that, like, yearly. Just blow it up. Like, just give back. Like, rain them with some enlightenment. You know, like, uplift the hood. Like,
right. You didn't complete your MBA because they got you right before you were... You had one semester left, you said?
I had one semester left. And I got enrolled when I was in prison to Adams State University. Took me a year to get in. Like, correspondence work doing the work on the yellow paper and folding it up and mailing it. And they grading it and sending it back in 2 months. So when I first copped, I copped out the 5 years. So I set up my academic schedule to be completed by the time I'm coming home, so I can still have my master's. I feel like me getting my master's in jail is something nobody could do. Like, how can you not respect that? Like,
yeah,
you have to respect that, because everything that's going on in here is darn near possible, like, to get a degree, like, if all this killing and all that going on. So, but I was getting to it. I was doing it. And my case flipped, like, you know, judge threw out my plea and I came home. So it's really hard now. We have to start from halfway, like, my credits would be halfway, and I will have to probably do like 9 classes.
Yeah. So what are you doing now?
I'm just entrepreneur work. I do shows, screenings. I speak. Spokesman person. I'm a brand ambassador. All of that. Music, act, everything. Like, everything that I can legally.
Right. Can you talk about the experiences of other people who I assume didn't have as kind of a philosophical attitude towards it and didn't necessarily...
Yeah, I mean, there's people in there, okay, you throw somebody 23 years, and now he's just, his hope is thrown away, and now it's just straight gang time. Like, doesn't care about nothing else. Like, and then he don't got family helping him. All he got is someone like me that's home, and I'm doing the right thing that's trying to help him. And it's like, and his life is like basically over. He come back when he's 50, 60.
Yeah.
No education. And it's a lot of them. You know, like, not everybody had the education I had, like, or even, I knew I was coming home. They know they're not coming home. I mean, every day, like, I'm home and I see the young kids and they like, yo, bro, I went to school because of you, bro.
Wow.
I only went to school because I seen you do it, bro. You took me up there with Cardi B, bro. Like, before all of this, Shiggy, bro. You know what I mean? I'm like, bro, just... keep pushing, bro. You see me still pushing, bro. Like, keep pushing, because I'm going to get somewhere. Like, I'm going to get somewhere. And I mean, if you keep pushing, you're going to get somewhere. Regardless, I'm going to take y'all with me. Like,
yeah. What's the Cardi B connection?
She used to, like, host parties. And before, like, she wasn't rapping at the time.
Right.
But we was rapping. And she was dating one of, like, the guys. And we linked up. And, like, it was just a lit night. We videos, like, all of that. And that was before she was on the Billboard. I get locked up. See on the Billboard magazine,
wow.
I'm like, whoa, you know, like, yo, and that just showed me where we could go, you know.
Is there, are you guys in touch?
Nah.
Because she's pretty, she has good politics.
I just want to remind y'all, because it's been a little bit over 3 weeks, okay? It's been a little bit over 3 weeks. Trump is now ordering, as in summoning, federal government workers to go back to work without getting paid. Now, I don't want to hear y'all talking about, oh, but Obama shut down the government for 17 days. Yeah, bitch, for health care. So your grandma could check her blood pressure and you bitches could go check your pussy in the gynecologist with no motherfucking problem. I know a lot of y'all don't care because y'all don't work for the government or y'all probably don't even have a job, but this shit is really serious, bro. This shit is crazy. Like, our country is in a hellhole right now.
Cardi B, if you're listening to this, you should get in on this case. Use your voice to highlight.
She know what's up with me. She knows
the Bronx 120.
She involved with home stuff.
And I pay my mama bills. I ain't got no time to chill.
She used to be one of us.
Yeah.
Like, YG.
I'm a boss to a worker, bitch. I make bloody moves. Bloody moves.
At this point, I asked Alex about his book, The End of Policing, which was published by Verso, and which, as you will hear, Craig had an interesting experience with.
Worked out the deal for the book with Verso actually before Ferguson happened, before Eric Garner was killed here in New York. And at the time, I thought, well, this will be a little thing in the corner of people's minds who work on these issues every day. But of course, the whole changing of the narrative, the mobilization of popular discontent, the rise of criminal justice reform has created a tremendous space for these ideas. And what I've seen is a growing number of national and local organizations giving up on the idea that body cameras and implicit bias training are going to fix policing. Or that another training program is going to fix policing, and that what we need is to invest in how to really make communities safer without putting people in cages. And that's the real solution that that we're looking for. And I think you're going to see a lot of interesting developments over the next 6 months in terms of the national conversation about criminal justice reform.
Yeah. And, you know, this, like, you can't make this up. But, Craig, can you tell us about the experience that you had with this book?
All right. So I think it was a Friday night. You know, we was about to go out. I was with two of my friends, Tink and Dottie, is my rappers, and we do our music thing. So we're going to, I think we was going to like a party or a show, wherever we was going. NYPD just runs down on me, like, quickly, pulls me out the car quickly. Like, all I see is sirens, and before I could even think, he's already out the window. First question I ask is like, officer, what I did wrong? He like, yo, I'm gonna tell you in a minute, get out the car. All right, I already know like what's going on. So I get out and I get to the back. The other officer starts searching the car, and now the guy's
with
talking
no
to me.
Permission, no nah,
nothing,
probable cause.
That's so regular. Is that illegal?
It is illegal. I mean, if I would have got in trouble and fight it in the state from the start, you shouldn't have been there. So at the end, they would have threw it away.
Right. And yeah. So
I know that.
Right. Right. So you're getting searched.
Yeah, we're getting searched
without cause.
Well, this is like the 10th time in like 2 weeks. So I'm looking at him like, yo, like, it's kind of like, I'm not even going to get too deep into it with him, like, about, but I'm like, yo, it's messed up because you know I'm about to get back in the car and go about my way. So you going to tell me why you pulled me over? He was like, I couldn't read your license plate. He was like, one of my lights on my license plate thing was off. I'm like, all right, but you pulled me over and read it. So what now? He didn't even run my license, nothing. So I'm looking at Tank looking at me, and I'm just like, yo, I'm thinking, I'm just hoping Tank don't talk. Don't talk. Like, Dottie just looking, he's bigger than me.
Dottie is another person.
He's a rapper, 6'5", 240, 250, you know, just came home. And the cop is probably intimidated.
Right.
So I'm waiting for them to take this to another level. The officer comes out the car with the
a copy of the end of policing
book. And he's looking at me, and I'm looking at him. And he's just like, yo, who are you? Like, what is this? And I'm like, oh, I'm an activist. Like, I got a degree, all that. And I'm tired of this happening to me. Like, that's why I'm reading this book. You should read it. He was like, oh, well, I'm going to look into it. And then he found my flyer to the documentary. He was like, nah, I'm going to look really into you. He's like, I'm going to see you again. I'm going to tell you. I read the book and I watched the documentary. So I already knew how powerful the book is. I ride with the book. I ride with it now. I swear on everything I love. I mean, if Tank could call up, I know he's listening, he could approve. Like, they let us go.
Right.
And by the time we were driving, Tank like, bro, like, I don't know how we got out of that one. I'm like, bro, you talking to the lawyer, bro. You know, like, if I didn't go away for 2 years, I would have had that certification.
Right. Each chapter, by the way, has an alternative. So it's not just kind of a depressing look at why the world is so terrible. It's that plus how we can make the world a better place. It has 10 chapters.
Or the first two kind of frame the problems with police reform, the history of policing, and then it takes 8 areas of policing that don't need to be reformed, they need to be eliminated.
Right,
and replaced with positive interventions.
Yeah. One of the most interesting things about this book is the look at the history of policing. And by the way, you know, not here, but in England, right, they call the police bobbies. Can you tell people where that comes from?
Yeah, they're named for Sir Robert Peel, Robert Bob the Bobbies, who invented them in the 1820s. And everyone was like, oh, this is this amazing thing. How did he come up with it? But what gets left out of that is that prior to inventing the London Metropolitan Police, he was in charge of the English occupation of Ireland. And it's in that colonial model, colonial context, that he begins to come up with policing. And this is true of the development of a lot of police forces internationally.
You talk about the history of the police, and it comes out of colonialism, right? It comes out of
like the Texas Rangers.
The Texas Rangers, you talk about, and the Juan Crow system, also slavery.
And we think usually of like rural slave patrols, but in the big cities like Charleston, Savannah, New Orleans, where they had these mobile slave populations working for wages, policing develops to manage that slave population.
Right. And also with industrial stuff, with strikes. So it really is a method of social control. And its origins, I mean, it would have to change radically from what it was to even be close to what it pretends to be, right? Which is something to keep people safe. These horrible stories that are in your book, violent responses to strikes, miners.
Yeah, my family were coal miners going back several generations, and so I learned some of this history growing up, but then was able to look into the details about how, you know, the suppression of workers' movements were at the core of forming many modern police departments.
And what got you interested in this theme in the first place? What made you write about it?
Yeah, it was not what I thought I was going to be doing once upon a time. I was working at the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness doing housing and economic development work, which is what I had studied. But this is when we saw the rise of broken windows policing, and little by little I got pulled into trying to deal with the repression of, the criminalization of poverty, right, basically.
What is Preet Bharara saying now about this case, you know, this hero of the resistance?
So Craig and I and some others, we confronted Preet at an event he did at the Brennan Center at NYU Law School. Because the Brennan Center has been pushing this big, you know, let's end mass incarceration. Right. And so they're celebrating Preet as part of the resistance to Trump. But he oversaw a lot of these gang prosecutions. Yeah. So,
and he bragged about it, right?
And he bragged about it on television and stuff. So we got them to discuss it at the event, and he was asked some tough questions. And basically his answer was, well, I trusted the police.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, but if you're such a great leader of the resistance, isn't that because you're making independent calls? You're finding out where the real principles are. And all the while, he's promoting this new book called Doing Justice.
Yeah.
So we also sent one of the moms up to an event in Scarsdale who spoke to him personally.
Oh, nice.
We gave him a letter. We've asked the Brennan Center to host an event to talk about this issue. And we asked him in a letter for him to talk with us. Neither of them have taken us up on that
Brennan
offer.
Come on, Brennan Center. You're supposed to be progressive, Brennan Center.
I had a call with them about a week and a half ago, but no response since then.
And what could be done right now? I mean, in an ideal world, let's say, like what could be done about all these people who are still in jail? Or what could be done with Craig, right? Because Craig is now a felon. I mean, can that be removed?
Well,
he wants to go
first
to law
of all,
school.
Preet Bharara should formally apologize, and he should call for clemency.
Yeah, I mean, Preet, call for clemency.
These charges should be dropped. These records should be expunged, and these young people should be able to get on with their lives. But also, we need the city of New York and the NYPD to quit criminalizing these young people and to develop credible pathways into something positive for these young people. Where are the community centers? Where are the summer jobs? Where are the counselors in the schools? All of those things have been replaced by police.
Right. So it's a question of there need to be these systemic shifts, right, away from police. And also there need to be these individual cases need to be addressed.
That's right.
On both levels. But yeah, imagine, again, like, I mean, I think listeners would get this, but if in case you're talking to your conservative friends or family members, imagine if your kids had their text messages turned over to the police. Imagine how incriminating they would be. Babe Howell, who is the professor of law who did this study on the Bronx 120, talks about how it's taking away people's childhoods, right? You're not letting kids be kids, teenagers be teenagers. It's also a divide and conquer thing. They're pitting people against each other. When they get out of jail, they can't hang out with each other. They can't follow each other on social media because they don't want to get in trouble.
And they spent years tracking these young people.
Right, yeah.
Doing nothing positive for them, watching them get deeper and deeper into trouble, some of them, and then hanging them out to dry. And I'm like, why weren't there positive interventions for years? If we know who these kids are who are at risk, why aren't we trying to do something positive for them? Instead, we're just trying to lead them into deeper and deeper problems.
And what are some of the positive things that they could...
Well, we've been supporting the use of violence interrupters, which are these community-based efforts to work with young people to kind of break the cycle of violence, to do culturally informed trauma counseling, the kind of stuff Tiffany Caban was talking about, to look for social inclusion strategies. Yeah, these young people are coming together, try to create street families, to find some meaning in their lives. Instead of criminalizing that, how can we work that into participatory budgeting, youth councils, work that into the community board structure. There, we can use that cohesiveness to produce something positive, to create basketball leagues, to create art programs. But there's never any money for that. But there's always, you know, but there's $11 billion to build new jails.
Right. Yeah. It's like the domestic version of, you know, no one's ever asked, how are you going to pay for that war? People are always asked, how are you going to pay for health care? It's a similar thing here. This is a domestic version, right? It's no one's asked, how are you going to pay for this prison, that prison, this increasing the budget of this police department? But they are asked about, how are you going to pay for this arts program, right?
Speeding cameras.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's so interesting because you were saying how you were working on homelessness before, and it really is. You see how much police, the issue of policing, it shouldn't be related to all these things, but it becomes something that, you know, it's about mental health. It becomes something that's about, it's an issue that is not just about solving crimes. It's really about controlling people, and it's in areas that has nothing to do, it shouldn't have anything to do with, and also sex work, and you know, all these things are such failed experiments. Like, how many times do we have to look at things to get that it's not working? You know, there's the school to prison pipeline. At this point in the interview, we had to move rooms, so you'll hear a change in the sound. Also, around 2/3 into the interview, Craig has to leave, but I continue my chat with Alex. But before we do that, here's a sample of Craig's song, Against the Wall.
This is for my ones behind the wall. I swear me and all my gonna ball. Mama said I gotta stand tall. If I don't stand for something, I'ma fall. I know that I gotta give my all. Cause today ain't gonna promise tomorrow. Haters wanna see me in the morgue. So every day you know I'm praying to the Lord.
April 26th, the feds came and it hurt.
Said it hurt.
In the courtroom, see my mama go berserk.
She was crying.
Never thought I'd see three flocka on a shirt.
No.
Death penalty, charged with murder in the first. A nigga home and they think I'm on.
Yeah, well, the rise of school policing is tied to the rise of high-stakes testing and kind of the zero-tolerance disciplinary systems that went along with that. You know, high-stakes testing is ultimately driven by austerity,
right?
Cutbacks in public support. Yeah. And so what they did was is that, you know, test scores went down as they cut all the extracurriculars, counselors, student teachers, you know. So then reformers, in quotes, you know, these conservative reformers who want to privatize education ultimately, they say, well, the schools aren't achieving enough because they're not focused enough on the basics. So let's even further degrade the curriculum, make school really boring, make everything rote teaching for the test and memorizing stuff for the test. Kids are bored, frustrated, act mm-hmm. out. And then that acting out behavior is criminalized. And teachers are like, well, I can't run the classroom, so I want these kids out of here. Mm-hmm. So I want more school police, more zero tolerance discipline. And in Texas, where Bush created this teaching miracle, education miracle, you know, the test scores went up because they took 20% of the kids right. and put them either in jail or in these jail schools that were not part of the testing regime. So yeah, the test scores look better because they X'd out 20% of the students.
Right. Oh, so there's wow. this incentive for
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's this incentive to wow. if you get funded, right, based on how well your kids test, you want to kick out the kids who aren't testing well. And of course standardized tests is such a random measure of intelligence. It's not really.
It's not a predictor of future yes. success yeah, or not, anything. Yeah. It's just
and
a
there's
metric.
There's very smart people who are bad at standardized testing. There's
yeah,
people
hard.
Who aren't that smart who are good at it. Yeah, not to be.
Well, and the worst yeah. thing were the charter schools.
Oh yeah.
Who
oh,
have
which Bernie did come out against.
He did
those.
Take a very strong position. So the charter schools have a double economic incentive because not only do they keep their programs afloat. But they got big, you know, seven-digit salaries riding on the success of these models. And so here in New York, the Success Academy had got-to-go lists with names of students who were dragging down the test scores, who they were trying to figure out how to drive out of these charter schools. And they did it by saying, oh, you're not wearing the right color shoes and you put your shirt on the wrong way and you know, you stood up in class when you weren't. So then they're calling the parents every day, making them come for a conference, suspending the kids. As early as elementary school, this is going on until, of course, either the parents take them out or they end up in the criminal justice system. So this is just an extension of this logic in its most extreme form.
And what was the most surprising thing that you discovered while you were working on this book?
Well, that actually was one of them, because a lot of the areas of the book, like homelessness, mental health, sex work, drugs, gangs even, I had done a lot of work on, but I hadn't thought so deeply about school policing. It wasn't something that I experienced as a kid, even in public schools in Houston. Even though there was violence and stuff, this turning it over to the police hadn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. And so that nexus between high-stakes testing and school policing was one of these aha moments for me.
Yeah. And what about, Craig, what can you tell people about your experience in jail? You know, because I think, again, you are this poster child, and people think, oh, well, great, he's out of jail now.
Yeah.
But there
was violence.
Yeah. What did you experience there and observe there?
I've seen people get stabbed. I've seen riots. I've seen police on inmate, like beating on the inmates. I've seen inmates trying to beat on the police. I've seen all types of degrading language. I've experienced it, like, from the first day I walked in there, like the correctional officer, the CO, like the guard, he was like talking to me crazy.
Like what?
This is my first day in there, and I got locked out my cell because I didn't know 9 o'clock is going to lock. So I went to ask for help. It's like he didn't want to help me. He wanted to take me to the box,
which is solitary confinement. Yeah.
And I'm like, why are you dealing with me like that?
Where were you when you said you were locked out?
I was in the day room area.
Okay.
Trying to get to my cell.
Right.
But he locked it.
And you didn't know because it was your first day.
Yeah, I didn't know. But when you get locked out, you either get a ticket or you're supposed to go to solitary confinement. So I started arguing with him like, you don't know me. Like, you don't, like, I'm educated. You trying to act like, but that didn't matter because I'm an inmate now. So that type of thing, that was wearing on me mentally. And then the fighting culture, because it's jail, like, you got to have testosterone. You got to be tough. So I had to get used to that, too. Seeing these certain things and not wanting it to happen to me put me in a position that I'm going to attack before I could be attacked. So I got on that, too. It was crazy. I mean, my first bunkie was actually a lifer, like a life sentence, someone with life on transit. Like, he was like a hitman. Like,
wow.
And I'm sitting there like, damn. He was Spanish, but he looked white, right? Whole body full of tattoos. So I'm coming in there with the cuffs on. They uncuff me at the gate, at the door. And they open the door, and I look at the CO, like, he's black. I'm like, yo, you really about to put me in here? Like, because I'm thinking
he's a
like,
white, like, Aryan brother.
Yeah, like, I'm coming from school. I don't know nothing. I'm just like, I don't have a choice. So they locked me in there, and he turned out to be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, he turned out to be, like an older, like, I got cool with him. I met my mom.
Did he give you any advice? Any helpful advice?
No. He didn't give me no. He can only give me like tough advice, how to be tough.
Well, that's what I mean. Advice to like get through.
I mean, no.
No.
He was in his own gang. He can't give me advice.
What gang was he in?
He was a Latin King.
Oh, interesting.
Or OG.
Yeah.
Like old, like 45. He can only give me advice in the street. But you've been in here, and you about to do the rest of your time in here. So whatever, right. You can only tell me how, like a knife. Give me a knife. Oh, and first day he was smoking. Like,
cigarettes
I think it was weed. It was weed.
Or crack.
And he was smoking K2. K2 is what they smoking in, so you can't detect it in your pee.
K2 what's K2?
Is synthetic weed.
Oh, got it. Okay.
That's the thing that have everybody going crazy out here. Like, it's crazy in there. So out here, no one smokes K2.
Right.
And there, everyone smokes K2.
It's not detectable.
Right? It's not detectable, whatever. You could go, I'm sure they could have gave them something else. Like,
and who's giving it to them?
I don't know. Like, where it came from, the culture came from. I'm guessing it could be the COs. You can't go outside. But I've smoked that before. It, like, burns your brain. Like, imagine doing 10 years, burning your brain 10 times a day, like burning it,
like it hurts you, or
like it's oh, that is a crazy thing. Like, I don't know if it's a drug or what is it, because I didn't know about it until I went to jail.
Yeah, it's really problematic. And it's one of these things where if we just made marijuana legal,
right.
K2 would kind of go away. The only reason people take it is to avoid drug tests and stuff. But it's not really it's not synthetic marijuana. It's just it's a drug that gets you high that's really cheap.
Yo.
And so people take it as a kind of tool, a drug of last resort. But of course, the other thing I'm hearing here is that this is a federal jail that is supposed to be at the center of the war on drugs, and everyone has access to drugs.
Right.
What? Yo, any drug.
Really?
Yeah.
Not just K2, but more?
No, anything. Like, I mean, it's costly, but...
Right, but you can get your hands on it.
Yeah, you get your hands on it.
Wow.
But the K2 thing, it's like, all right, 5 years of that. Like,
yeah.
Where your brain cells going to be? And then you got a felony, no education. I'm educated to know, like, yo, nah, I'll do the cigarettes.
Right.
Like, and I'm okay.
Did you ever get sent to the box?
Yes, I did. Because I didn't follow direct orders. I didn't go where they wanted me to go. Because I spent, like, a year in one house. Got accustomed, adapt. This is, like, my house. I live here now.
Right.
They moved me and put me in a house where I don't know anybody here. And it's a beef going on. I don't know what's going on. So
why didn't they move you?
I don't know.
Okay.
That's how they do it. They pick you up. If I was in MDC, if I was already in a prison, they could just do that and send me to the other side of America.
Right.
Like, that's just how it works. Like, I don't know if they pick your hand out or they just want to shake you up.
Right.
But I didn't go into the house. Like, I told them, nah, I'm not. It's over. They took me to the box. I knew I was going to the box. But when I got out the box, I got to a house that, like, seven of my friends.
So they moved you.
Yeah, after the box, they moved me again. So.
And how long were you in the box in solitary?
2 weeks. You were in solitary for 2 weeks?
Yeah, 14 days.
What was that like?
I read Game of Thrones.
Oh, they let you have something
books,
to read?
That's it. Like, that's it.
Did you lose track of time? I've heard that happens, but.
Yeah, I did. I didn't really care what day it was.
Right.
Just know, okay, it's milk and cereal. This is morning. The middle is not too hot. Get a sandwich or something. But 5 is dinner. And then when the process repeats, a new day.
Wow. How was dinner and lunch?
Horrible. You ain't season it, nothing. It's like water beans. Like beans that's in water. Like thick water.
Wow.
Like no flavor. Nothing. Commissary. Make your own food. Make your own twist on your food. Commissary, you could buy some seasoning.
Wow.
So whatever you get, garlic powder is going on there. Like anything.
Yeah, I would choose that. My one.
Salt and pepper.
Hot flakes ever?
Hot what?
Like the flakes. The
Nah. No, we didn't even have a microwave. So we had
The pepper like on pizza.
Oh, flakes. Yes. Did they have that type? Yeah, but you ain't really see people dealing with that.
And you can't have commissary in solitary, can you?
You have it, but not like crackers, toiletries, nothing to smile about.
Yeah.
Like, that's punishment. That's jail inside of jail.
Right. I didn't know that they would let you read, honestly. I thought it would be. I'll
tell you something about that. I'm reading with the light on. CO sees me. I'm reading with the light on. I'm in a box, like. Turns my light off. The light's on the outside. I can't. So now, it's a little light coming through the little box of the door. I got to sit under the door to get the light because I can't sleep because I done slept all day. Forced me to read the light. Yeah, it's crazy.
Why they do that? Just to be...
assholes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah, this isn't radio, so you can curse. Yeah.
Yeah. Assholes.
Wow.
He's black, too.
It does
be like that.
Were you surprised that it wasn't like, did you before jail, maybe you already knew this from the experiences you had and your friends, but before jail, did you think like having a black CO would be easier than having a white CO?
Yeah. And I did.
And then, but what was your actual experience?
They're all black. Well, I was at, they were all black. I didn't go up state in the right. state jail. I'm sure it's bad up there too, but we dealing with it with our own kind. I used to hit them like, yo, I could be your kid. Like,
yeah.
I'm like, yo, the way you treating me, man, to you don't even know who you dealing with. Like, you dealing with like, a good person. Like, your kid could do be here.
Right.
Just like I'm here.
What would they say?
And he's like, nah, they wouldn't. All right.
Did you meet people? Were they, was anyone like surprised when you said you were getting your MBA? Did it change how they treated you? Besides like the cops in the car where we were talking about that, but.
Not every CO was horrible. Not every CO. I'm not going to sit here and act like it was horrible. Because once they found out who I was, they did try. But some of them was just like a trained, like, sergeant. Like,
yeah.
Brainwashed. Like, I don't, like, straight cop. Like, no heart.
Right. And, of course, it shouldn't, like, you know, they should not treat people like crap if they don't have college degrees, right?
Yeah. But it's not even like that. It doesn't matter. I'm in these grays and they're in their uniform. Like, sometimes I sit in my sweatpants that I have on and it's like a privilege to have regular clothes. Like, once you come out of there, got a man that smuggled whatever, $30, $40 million, and me and him are wearing the same clothes. Like, and you...
You mean in jail?
Yeah, in jail. Yeah. We can't... There's no different from you and me right. in here. None. You could be 50 years old. I don't have to respect you. Like, I'm in the same jail as you.
Mm.
I met people like you, Alex. Like, lawyers. Like, that got caught up. Lawyers. I'm talking millionaires. And they loved me. I met them in church. They would stop me and be like, yo. Because they can't connect to the real gang members, the gangsters, like the people, like, you know, that come out the jail and they run into jail. Ain't nobody gonna talk over there to them.
Yeah.
And I meet with them in church and then I leave that and go back with my guys and they see me and now it's like they'll come say hi to me and now they can say hi to everybody else.
Right.
And they like, yo, you special. Like, you're special. And I used to go, like, I'll speak now, I speak to the people in the church, tell my story. Like, no holds barred. I'm telling them, like, I don't know why this is happening to me, but it has to be a reason. Like, because I haven't even killed anybody to right. be on the death penalty right now. Like, it's like, I don't know what the purpose is, and everybody felt that.
But you were never, the death penalty was never
Nah, look, when I first got right. there, the first day, April 26th, all of us were on capital punishment. Everybody. Because I got hit with the RICO. The RICO is murder, attempt.
Conspiracy to commit murder.
Oh, everything. Like, every crime, serious crime, is under the RICO statute. It even goes to white collar crimes. Smuggling the money, whatever.
Money laundering.
Money laundering. Mortgage fraud. Anything, like, can fall under the RICO. It's a conspiracy. So... you got someone that committed a murder that's a part of the group.
Right.
So initially, right. we're all charged. Wow.
One of the findings of Babe Howe's report was that for months, there was no individuation of the charges. So everyone is just charged with conspiracy to distribute narcotics and conspiracy to commit murder. And there's no articulation of who did what the accusation. So everyone is facing the potential of life in prison, the death penalty, etc. Gosh,
like, the way they did it was so, like, I was like wow.
Yeah, how did you find out?
People are like stronger than, like, they giving you the impression that they are God. Like, they are the button. Like, you, how can I sit here and tell you, like, I didn't shoot anyone, rob anyone, anything. More time, I went to school and I'm stopping the violence right now. Like, you're not me, because we right. in here and people are still getting shot. But I'm being charged with all of this and you won't even, like, look at the case. Like, you won't even look or right. take what we're saying serious. Like, you X-ing out what we're saying. So take all the good. And you're listening to the prosecutor who's lying about all the bad. And then you're going with that and to apologize to me 2 years later.
Yeah, what happened to the prosecutors?
They are gone, all of them. Rachel Maimon quit. I don't know what happened to her. The magistrate that got me the original bail quit. Preet Bharara's story. Right. His whole team is out of office. It's like, now...
And did they break the law, though? Or technically, they didn't do any... Technically, they didn't do anything wrong, right?
Ethics.
It's a question of ethics. I mean, there's a fundamental question here about the appropriateness of these RICO charges, which... The charges rest on the claim that this is a criminal enterprise and that that's why they need to charge everyone with these high-level felonies. But in the end, you know, over half the young people aren't even accused of being in a gang, much less an enterprise. Almost every single one of the defendants was eligible for a government-paid public defender because they did not have two dimes to rub together. This is not a criminal enterprise. They should not be using these prosecutions to go after young people, mostly involved in marijuana and other very low-level youthful behavior that could be dealt with in radically different ways.
At a time where crime is at the lowest in history.
Right, yeah.
Why?
But yeah, and one of the people who was you guys were connected to was someone who was already serving jail time for shooting someone, like it ricocheted.
Hit an old lady?
Yeah.
I don't know that
and
kid.
He's
on the other side. Like, he's a part of it, too.
But as if you guys had anything. I mean, that was, he's already in jail, and.
That had nothing to do with my side of town anyway.
Yeah.
I don't even know why they even, like, that had nothing to do with none of us. Like,
these things were just excuses.
Yeah, that's all it
was. To give the police and prosecutors a blank check to wipe out a whole demographic of young people in these neighborhoods. And the mindset of the NYPD is that in their drive to keep pushing the violence numbers lower, that the way to do that is to focus on a kind of demographic segment of young people of color in and around mostly public housing developments. And they're like, well, we know this is where most of the remaining violence is. We can't use stop and frisk anymore. We can't use these trespass. So we're going to use these gang cases to just wipe out that whole cohort. And the occasional shooting, murder, whatever, becomes just a pretext to give them the tools to just wipe out everybody.
Pretext.
Yeah.
I said, 120 gang members, I actually looked it up yesterday on Pix 11, and I watched it, and it was like, and I'm really watching it like, yo,
the press conference
they were doing while I was being chained. And brought in, you making it seem like I was a part of some whole other, like, and then when you look
at
it.
The worst of the worst.
Yeah. I really you're not going to be terrorizing
like, historic, epic.
They're all patting.
Great work, I love it.
Your buddies and family anymore. Yeah.
And they're all patting themselves on the back about how great they are.
And now that I'm free, like, what do you think exactly? But I could look all of them in their face and have a conversation. I'm educated. You can't come around here and act like I don't know what I'm talking about. I read the same books you read. I walk across stages, and I'm going to continue to do that. I mean, I feel like now, as a black man, I got way more to prove coming from where I come from. I got to keep going back and looking at these people who's, like, it's like set up. Like, it's a system. Like, you on probation. That day that I got pulled over, if my probation calls me and know that I was even driving with my friend, that's a possibility of violating my probation. What crime did I commit to go back to jail? I didn't commit one in the first place. Right. Then again, they could do it. And there's other ways that you could go through this. And it really messes up your mental health, like families. You got 120 people who have families. Yeah.
Right, what do they think happens to the
five, six, seven people that's behind one person? Like, what happens to his sisters and brothers and kids?
Right.
Well, we work with some of the parents of some of the young people who've been caught up in these raids, and you know, they're under tremendous pressure. Yeah. And some of them who have bravely spoken out have their children have been punished for it, have been put in solitary, have been moved to other facilities. So not only are they dealing with the consequences of the arrest, but they're fearful about anything they say having consequences for their children. And one of the really caustic dynamics of this is that a lot of the prosecutions end up relying on different people in the case testifying against each other, which then creates a lot of tension in the community about whose kid is testifying about who else's kid. Now, in the Bronx 120, I think the families have been pretty good about keeping it together, and not and the actual young people have not gotten into big beefs over that. Mm-hmm. But in some cases, this has just generated new violence because everyone's angry about what happened as a result of the prosecution.
It ain't the people that's going through it that came home. It'll be people that like sees what's happening. The outsiders, somebody trying to make a name for themselves. Oh. Like, that's what's going on. I'm there. Like, my co-defendants, I got one that's in jail right now. I don't know what he did. He violated it. But outside of that, nobody gets in trouble. Mm. We trying to avoid the cops. They're on us. We not on the crime. Like you, there's a reason why we're home. The influences are gone. Like, that's all it is. Like, an influence to be tough and... I mean, Mad Dog is the leader and they want to be Mad Dog, so he might have the power to tell them what to do. Like, I got the power to tell them what to do, but I'm telling them to do the right thing. And it don't get looked upon as heavenly, but I could be praised for giving a gun to a little kid and make him go shoot somebody. They'll praise me for that, and I'm not on that. Like, I never, like, nah, I'm past that whole thinking that was cool thing. I'm trying to be successful, and I want them to be successful. So,
what about, to play devil's advocate, and this is not something I think at all, but what about someone who goes, oh, you see, it worked. You went to jail, and now you're not thinking that way anymore, and...
I went to college.
It's a deterrent. Okay, that's... So you're... That so deterred that's what, yeah.
Not...
Right.
I'm not
Which is a great
kid.
Example of...
I got my experience, my college experience of living on my own, and I seen how you're supposed to... move. Yeah. I wasn't living in New York City, the crazy New York City. I was actually living in one of the richest states, Connecticut, and where the night ends at what, 10?
Yeah.
The roads are quiet at 11. That's normal. Like,
yeah, I went to college.
This ain't normal. I'm telling you, New York City, this is a jungle up here. Like, they don't sleep. I mean, everybody's sleeping habits are off. Everybody's running around. Up there, bed 11, wake up for work at 7, hit the highway. Traffic is ain't even as bad. Like, but I got my education, came back home in the summers and started to see like Mount St. Michael. Like, I was woken from ninth grade. Like, I already knew, all right, what you want to be? Lawyer to help my friends who go in and out of jail. It's different. Like, I didn't need to go to jail for that. Like I said, stop the violence is what I was doing, trying to like make a impact for the kids. The same thing that I'm doing now is just I have more, not more reason, more passion. Like, just like it means more to me now. Like, I like it meant a lot before. It just means more now. I'm on the same time, just better. Get better with wine, like wine, fine wine, better with time. And they gave me time. So.
Right. Although some programs do this, right? But obviously just having you people like leave that community is not a broad-based policy solution, right? Because it's like he's the exception.
Yeah, I mean, you've got so many failures built on top of one another. You know, we've got the highest level of residential segregation that we've ever had historically. So we have entrenched... geographically isolated racial segregation with degraded institutions, you know, schools that don't have the resources to deal with what is a high needs population. We got mass homelessness. 1 in 10 school kids in New York is homeless, and a heavy concentration of that is in exactly these same communities. You've got a degraded child welfare system. You know, a huge predictor of involvement in the criminal justice system is involvement in welfare, in child protective services, foster care, etc. You know, everything is working against these young people. There are very few community facilities that they just don't see a future for themselves that is positive. You know, they don't see a pathway forward. And so we've got to take a holistic approach to this.
Yeah. And where are you going now? And I want to, if you have time, I have a question about your son, but you probably, I can ask you that later. But
I'm going to a high school where I'm doing a program where I'm teaching the kids on, like, what can happen to you through the gang culture. Like, I'm screening my film, Trouble Finds You. I'm going to talk about that segment and how we can help the kids over there in Harlem. So
are they paying you an honorarium? I hope they do.
I mean, that's what I'm going to talk about now.
Oh, good.
This is needed.
Yeah.
And ain't just anybody could go up in front of them and really give them this material the way I could give it to
them.
They
would do that, I'm sure, with another guest who wasn't.
Like that was.
Well, and also, how many school resource officers are there in that school? And how could they, you know, someone like Craig could, you know, really transform a school with young people?
Yeah, of course, right.
And, you know, that would be just, why don't we have people like Craig who are working in these schools who can really speak to these young people from a position of mutual understanding and respect? To try to transform the learning environment into something positive for these young people, but instead, constant criminalization, surveillance, monitoring, degrading treatment, etc.
Yeah.
And then they're going to look at me like, probably, I mean, I, about my education, I went so hard for education because I didn't want to change who I was. Like, I just wanted to be myself, and I wanted them to respect me for who I am. I thought, like, the higher I get in my education, I could still, like, do my grades, you know, dress how I dress.
Right.
Like, and I wish, like, it was different, like, because right now I feel like that's not, like, how it is. Like, it doesn't matter. Education, you can still get wrapped up, or you can, when you get pulled over, out there for an hour and a half, you get belligerent, now you're in the bookings, you know?
So do you ever consider cutting your hair, for instance? You just mentioned your braids, because you think that would be just what, like...
I feel like, I'll give you another example. Yeah. I'm going to get sentenced. He changed my plea. He threw out the plea. I didn't have to cut my hair for that. You know? Like, so why would I cut my hair? Because to y'all, or to my peers and my friends... Me cutting my hair is going to be looking better to the judge and might help the judge look at me like, but I walked in there, me.
Right. No, I brought that up because you said the thing about how braids, what I took like you to mean outlook. Is that your education doesn't protect you from being profiled.
No, it doesn't. It's really a shame. Like, until I start talking to somebody.
Right.
Because once I start talking, then they be like, whoa. Every time. It never fails. Like, once I leave the Bronx, I go somewhere at first until I get to start talking with them. Now we click.
Yeah. So it just feels like you'd be selling out or...
I'm selling myself short for somebody else.
Right, yeah.
And I'm not doing that. Like, just like I'm all for making money. But what I learned in school and the degrees that I chased and my lane that the industry that I wanted to be in, like, to force me into construction is, like, oppressing me.
Yeah.
Like, for real. Like, if you're telling me the easiest way and the only way I could do to make a good living is to go break my back, and I got all this knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, I kept my hair. I'm just keep getting smarter.
You what?
I kept my hair. I kept it.
Yeah. No, when you brought that up, I was just thinking about how, like, it's interesting in some ways that, you know, like, it is not this, it is kind of resistance, right? Like, you're not conforming to, because I'm sure you got pressured from, did you get your lawyers pressure you and stuff?
No, my lawyer, he ain't pressured me to cut my hair or nothing. I've been pressured before to cut my hair, but because I'm an entrepreneur. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, and
you have a brand.
Yeah, like, I mean, come on. I'm doing all of this. Like, all of this, I'm carrying everything.
Right.
You can't tell me, like, cutting my hair is gonna get me to another place, and my education is not. Then it's not worth
but
it.
But do you think it would?
Nah, I don't.
You don't think it makes a difference?
No.
I'm just curious. I'm not advocating for that.
I don't.
I'm just curious
black.
If it's...
No. No. It doesn't. And then I have a scar. So it's like...
Right. Your dad, so in that documentary, yeah. Your dad talks about how you have this triple birth. What, you're black, you're
black.
Male, you're from...
He's got a felony.
I got a felony.
And now on top of it, you have a felony,
scar,
right?
Scar, black, yeah. Felony.
Number one, you got a scar on your face. And then number two, now you got a felony. So you got two strikes against you. Then you got the third strike, you're black. So your walk is heavy.
What's the scar from?
When I was younger, I was fighting somebody. And I got snuck by somebody else, and I got cut. That's young. I was young.
How old?
17. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everybody think it happened in jail or something.
Right.
It's like, no, it's outside.
And did that change the way you
definitely.
Were perceived, you think?
No.
No.
I don't think it changed how I was perceived. It just changed my mental. Like, because people knew me where I was from. And then I already started school. They knew I was good. Like, I was special. I was basketball.
Yeah.
Doing everything. Oh, I got a cut in my face. I look good. That's jealousy.
Was it scary? When it happened?
It wasn't scary. It was just...
It's because it's near your
shocking.
Eye. For listeners, I just... Can I?
Yeah. I thought I got punched.
Under your eye and then to your lip. It's on like a diagonal. And then you got stitches right away? Or?
Yeah, I when I got back to my house, my face was open.
Oh,
I
my
went
God.
To the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah. Been through a lot.
Yeah. And your son, how is he?
He's good. New York, he's going to school. He's everything to me. You know, that's my son.
I wanted to see my dad. It was hard to think because I called him. Every day I would pray, I hope my dad gets out of jail. One day actually came true.
I can't see him do no wrong in my eyes. Like, I mean, this is my son. I miss him. You know, I love my kid. Like, I don't want to be biased, but I really see exactly what you're saying now. Like, when I go to my son's school and it's nothing but black and Spanish kids, and they're all like with I go to the parent teacher conferences and we all got similar traits and similar things going on, and I'm just like, yo, why is it like this? I go travel to Manhattan and I come back here and it's like it looks crazy to me. Like, I'm telling you, everybody black,
like the difference?
And Spanish, everybody. Like, I go to the Bronx Zoo and it's 100 black and Spanish people, and I'm like, alright, so 120 man raid, 120 kids. I'm like, yo, this is crazy to me. Like it just psychological thing to me. I'm just looking at it like, wow.
It's the new Jim Crow.
Yeah.
Crazy to me. Like, I can go to the zoo. Go to the zoo and I'm looking at the snakes and I'm like, damn, they gave you a life sentence.
you should become an animal rights activist. Yeah.
Oh, man. But, I mean, everything I went through, it amounted to this. This is great. I know bigger things is coming for me. Thank God that I took the education serious, because if I didn't, I don't know what I'd be doing right now. I got to run.
Okay. Well, thank
school.
You. Thank you so much, Craig.
I'll be back.
Yeah, come back. Definitely. Is there value in, like, obviously, my orientation, your orientation, it's not about punishment, right? I do have, vindictive fantasies about, not even vindictive, but like, does punishing police have any accountability value? Does it act as a deterrent at all?
So this is like the tough question to come to grips with here. So there needs to be accountability. There are police who've caused tremendous harm as individuals. They obviously should not be police officers.
Right.
But my view is that a lot of the police officers who are well-intentioned and trying hard to do the right thing should also not be police officers.
Right.
Because we should not be using police to do all these things. And the other part is, there's no reason really to believe that throwing a few police in prison, firing a few police, is going to change the impact of policing on poor people and poor people of color in particular. And of course, the
because
they're still going to be waging the war on drugs and a war on crime and a war on terror and a war on immigrants and a war on gangs and all this stuff. And so even a totally lawful, unbiased, properly executed drug arrest is still fundamentally unjust. It's going to ruin some young person's life for no damn good reason. And it just does not matter what the accountability mechanisms are that are in place. It's irrelevant. Instead, why are we criminalizing drugs in this way? That's a political problem. It's a question of political accountability. And the final problem with all of this is that it rests on a philosophy of deterrence that says if we just punish enough cops severely enough, they'll change their behavior. Well, we've put literally millions of people in prison for drugs, and it has done nothing to change anyone's behavior. This idea that we can use punishments and threats to change human behavior, even if it works, it does so at a huge human cost. And we basically sell our souls to the devil when we go down this line of reasoning. And so it's the toughest sell I have as I crisscross the country talking about these ideas with community groups, with folks who've suffered terrible losses at the hands of the police. Yes, we want accountability, but don't assume or imagine that that's going to change policing in any meaningful way, because it just isn't.
I mean, yes, I obviously see what you're saying when you zoom out. And I don't think, I mean, I hate, there's this race to the bottomism where, like, you know, like a white kid does something and he doesn't get sentenced. And then people are like, I want him to be sentenced. It's like, that's really, it's the we should
call
be
them
advocating.
All terrorists.
Yeah, we should, right, exactly, right? When that's like falling into the trap, and we should be advocating for the people who are overly punished to not be, as opposed to the other way around. Although I get the temptation of seeing it that way. Is there not a difference between systemic, I mean, maybe this is the, it's begging for scraps, but systemic kind of like the war on drugs being terrible, systemic racist classes. But it's hard to tell a family, isn't it, that, well, just one person being not killed by cops, if accountability does work, let's say for argument's sake, right? Can't we do both things at the same time?
Right. Well, I think I'm not against, you know, having Pantaleo suffer consequences for killing Eric Garner. But what about the lieutenant who texted back, no big deal? What about the chief who ordered the operation in the first place? What about a whole culture of politics in New York City that says the way we make neighborhoods better is to throw the black and brown people in them in prison, or constantly harass them, stop and frisk them, threaten them? Where's the accountability there? And the thing is, accountability at that level might actually make a difference in improving the lives of people in these communities. And too often, some local politician, some city council member comes out on the picket line with us when someone gets killed, saying, yeah, we need accountability for that officer. And then they go back to the city council and vote for more police, vote to cut mental health services, you know, vote to oppose safe injection facilities. These are the things that would actually make these communities safer, stronger, healthier, more resilient. But instead, they want to keep giving us more police.
And what about with prosecutors for, let's say, misconduct?
There is actually a massive increase in attention to the role of prosecutors in driving mass incarceration. The Justice Collaborative, the work of John Pfaff at Fordham Law School has really helped shape public awareness of this. But the solution to this is also political. But the solution is political. And to their credit, what a lot of these folks are doing is they're focusing on the electoral process, especially for elected DAs in the counties across the country who are the main drivers of this. I mean, the feds are important, but we have the power to vote these people out of office. And it's starting to happen. It's very exciting. And yes, I think there are limits to what we can achieve through that, and maybe we should view it as a kind of harm reduction strategy. Yeah. But I think where there are candidates, like there are in Queens, like there were in Philadelphia when Krasner got elected, who have a really transformative vision, I think we should embrace that. We should put some resources into that with the understanding that that's just one part of a broader political accountability strategy. Right. And that the other part of it has to be that making the demands for the basic resources that communities should have to be able to manage their own affairs, to be free of crime and disorder.
And it's like one of the best things that a DA can do is decarcerate, refrain from prosecuting.
That's right, refraining from taking action.
Yeah.
I mean, DAs also have financial resources. And one of the interesting things about the Queens DA race is that there's over $100 million in asset forfeiture money sitting in that office. And similarly, in Manhattan, there's hundreds of millions of dollars in bank settlements. So they have actual positive resources that they could be spending on transformative initiatives in the communities, creating community-based mental health structures, culturally appropriate trauma services for young people to try to break the cycle of violence. So some candidates are talking about using that money in this transformative way, while others still think about, well, we'll do, you know, drug education in the schools.
Right.
Or give it, you know, and give it to parole. This is cop think,
yeah,
and not part of the solution.
Right.
It's part of the problem.
Another interesting thing that you mentioned in your book, which I really do recommend, and the history section is fascinating, but you mentioned in the book how being armed is actually, for cops, can create more higher fatality levels, right?
Yeah, it's complicated. It's so of
talking
course the
yeah yeah
you
polemicist.
Know the British police mostly are not armed,
yeah,
and rarely get killed. Now of course the handguns are not widely available in
right,
the UK,
right.
So it's
so
a compounding,
say, yeah,
complicating thing. But when an unarmed police officer is confronted by an armed suspect, the armed suspect has no incentive to kill them.
Right.
They can just get away.
Right. Right.
So lives are saved, both the life of law enforcement officers and the lives of suspects. Obviously, it's not an ideal situation. You know, we would love to see less encounters,
sure,
that look like this, but we should not assume that just because Americans have guns that therefore police need to have a lot of guns is the solution. And of course, the bigger thing is how many jobs that armed police do today in the United States could be done by other people,
yeah,
who don't carry weapons. And I think that's really the main way to think about disarming policing is let's get all those armed police out of our schools.
Right.
Let's quit sending armed police to manage homelessness, mental health problems, sex work, drugs. They don't play a positive role in those dynamics. The guns just poison the interactions, and we'd all be a lot better off without them.
And do any countries have models that you think are good?
A lot of places have bits and pieces. So New Zealand has legalized sex work. So it's not a concern of the police anymore.
Right.
There are regulations, and some people want decriminalization, which would be just to treat it like any other business. But of course, any business is subject to tax law and health and safety regulations,
right,
you know. So something like that.
You mean here they want decriminalization?
Yeah,
right.
You know, the decrim New York.
Right.
In New Zealand, they have full legalization and limited regulation. In Germany, there are places with legalization and very heavy punitive regulation,
right,
which keeps the black market alive,
right,
on the side.
Yeah.
So that's not ideal. That's true also in parts of Mexico, in Nevada, here in the United States. On drugs, we can look to Portugal, which has decriminalized,
right,
all drugs, basically got police out of the drug business, focus on the public health issues. The health outcomes have been very positive as a result of this. Crime and disorder and drug usage have not gone up. Civilization,
right,
did not collapse.
Yeah.
And there's no reason why we couldn't do the same thing here. Look at different regimes of legalization. There have been places where heroin was legal with a prescription. You just went to the doctor,
right,
got a prescription. You don't have to steal money to pay for drugs. There's no black market activity. No overdoses, people go back to work, the outcomes are very positive. I recommend the book Chasing the Scream.
I've had Johan on this
background.
Yeah.
And there are places that are trying to figure out how to quit criminalizing poverty to the same extent, that are looking at housing first models, trying to rebuild mental health infrastructures. You know, in the UK, in theory, if someone is having a mental health crisis and a family member needs help, they call the National Health Service emergency number. The police have nothing to do with it.
Right.
And they have 24-hour capability to respond to crises. And they don't have as many crises because people get regular health care because they have national health insurance.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah, lots of countries have pieces and lots of places do. And we just need to kind of pull that together into a kind of framework that I think we could think of as a real robust kind of social democratic framework.
Yeah. And what's the ultimate goal if you're, because you are an abolitionist, right?
I think abolition is really important framework for understanding the ways in which most reforms merely legitimate fundamentally unjust systems, putting people in cages, using police to manage social problems. That's not to say that there could never be anything that looks like a police officer. There could never be the need to like separate someone in some way. Yes, but abolition drives us to do the hard work of thinking always first about how do we build people up? How do we make communities stronger? And how do we understand punitive interventions as the tool of last resort always?
Right.
So the ultimate vision is to have self-sustainable communities that are able to regulate their affairs in through informal social controls, which is how wealthy resource neighborhoods do manage their affairs. Police are not an active part of the lives of people. They already have abolition.
Yeah,
you know, if you go to a fancy private school on the Upper East Side and you get caught with drugs, they do not call the police.
Right.
They're like, Katie, why did you do that? Yeah. They don't even call your parents most of the time. They're like, give me the drugs.
Right.
Now go back to class. I don't want to see this ever again. Right. You have endless chances. Right. And so we're going to, and if there really is a problem, we're going to get the parents involved. We're going to get a clinic involved, a therapist. Right. We're going to solve the problem.
Yeah.
Well, why can't every community have that?
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Oh, Pantaleo. What's happening with that? And what was that text you referred to? I didn't even know about this. The text message from...
Oh, yes. So during the incident, one of the officers texted the lieutenant on duty at the precinct saying, it looks like we might have a death in this stakeout, you know, operation we've been running. And the lieutenant was like, well, it was a legitimate arrest, so it's no big deal.
Wow.
Yeah. So where's the accountability for that person, right? Well, of course, there won't be any accountability. And if you to fire that guy, you'd have to fire every police officer because that's the whole mindset of the institution. The case is moving forward. There's, you know, been evidence that it was a chokehold and evidence that it wasn't a chokehold. To me, that's somewhat irrelevant. He was obviously medically compromised.
Right.
Eric Garner was the person who died, but there were tens of thousands of interactions like this that were equally unjust, demeaning, degrading, and should be stopped. And so, you know, yes, there should be some consequences for the officers who not only killed him, but did nothing about the fact that he might be dying. Or dead, you know, the casual disregard for his well-being. So, there should be consequences. But until we get rid of broken windows policing, until we deal with what was driving that kind of disregard for people's well-being, the consequences for communities of color are going to remain unchanged.
Yeah. I know you just looked at the different candidates.
For 2020.
2020. There are different positions. So tell us where the different candidates stand on criminal justice issues.
Well, a lot of my comments are based on this new book/report from the Brennan Center, where they got statements about criminal justice reform from most of the Democratic candidates, from the Trump White House, from also the conservative Koch brother prison reform movement. And I think for the Brennan Center, they're trying to make the point that there is now, you know, a bipartisan drive for some serious reform, that the First Step Act is not the end of the conversation, that there needs to be more. So the First Step Act was the first attempt at some kind of bipartisan federal level prison reform, you know, so approved by Republicans and Democrats in Congress and signed by Trump. And it did reduce some sentencings. It did allow for a handful of people to get out retroactively, but it's very thin. And even it was, you know, very controversial. McConnell didn't want to let it come up for a vote, et cetera.
The turtle.
Yeah. But as we know, the problems are both much deeper at the federal level, and the vast majority of people in prison are there on state charges. So there have to be changes at the state level. Now, part of how we got into this mess was the 94 crime bill signed mm-hmm. by Clinton that incentivized states to build prisons, hire more police, increase sentencing lengths, etc. So none of the candidates are talking explicitly enough about that misstep. Interestingly, the Republicans some talk about the 94 crime bill because they can blame it on the Democrats.
Right.
A lot of people are talking about bail reform. A lot of talk, the people are talking about, you know, changes to parole. There is no federal parole anymore, so they want to bring that back. I was struck by a couple of things. One is that Sherrod Brown, he took a position that the most important element of criminal justice reform is wage reform, putting people to work at a living wage. And I think that's a really important way of thinking about
Senator
this.
Senator from Ohio.
Rather than just tinkering with a few sentences and dialing back marijuana charges, if we can really put people to work, that's going to reduce the drives that get people into trouble. I also thought, interestingly, that Beto O'Rourke's position was the most detailed and had a really lot of good elements. Called for ending the drug war across the board, focused on marijuana stuff, but it was end the drug war. Good stuff about sentencing reform, but also just rethinking our reliance on the criminal justice system to solve problems. And it was a very solid statement that I think people should look at. The most disappointing to me was actually Bernie's. Mm. Now, Bernie has, of course, a long record of calling out the criminalization of poverty, mass incarceration, etc. But his statement for this pretty important volume was limited to a critique of private for-profit mm-hmm. prisons, which I think is really misguided. This is a tiny piece right. of the puzzle. It does not get to the real underlying drivers of mass incarceration. And it's the kind of thing I would expect someone who doesn't really want to engage this issue to embrace. So I was really disappointed by that. You know, Cory Booker talked about, you know, taking the First Step Act a little bit further.
Two-step act.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, he's great on marijuana legalization, right. but kind of thin on the rest of it.
And Warren...
Warren had some good kind of technical fixes right. for a handful of things, but I didn't see a real strong vision
yeah.
there.
She was very econ-based.
Yeah.
I mean, she's great on that stuff, but yeah.
To me, one of the most exciting things that's in the work nationally is a big coalition of civil rights groups is working on a counter to the 94 crime bill, which is taking each of the provisions of the 94 crime bill that drove mass criminalization and mass incarceration and trying to flip it on its head. So instead of a massive subsidizing of school police, let's have a massive subsidizing of school counselors, restorative justice programs, bring back, you know, extracurricular sports activities so that we rejuvenate this as a learning environment, not as a criminal justice environment.
And Sherrod Brown, you mentioned him at the beginning, even though he's not running, but he, for whatever reason...
He had a really good position on this.
So this was all the Dems that they asked, not just people running.
It wasn't just people running. They had Van Jones was in there, the head of Color for Change, NAACP. Yes, yeah. NAACP, Eiffel at LDF. And interestingly, you know, some of the advocates also had very thin positions.
Huh. Interesting.
And I don't know if it's because they're trying to create this kind of lowest common denominator consensus, which is, of course, how we got the First Step Act.
Right.
But I was really disappointed that the kinds of folks who got chosen for this, you know, felt like a lot of tinkering for the most part. You know, Van Jones had some good stuff. His whole thing is cut the prison population in half. But to do that requires a massive rethinking of the way we use policing, the way we produce public safety in communities. And what I did not see in that document was a real thinking about how that would be done. But I know in the civil rights community, there is a lot of talk going on about that. There are a lot of policy position papers and frameworks that I've seen drafts of in the last year that are all moving in that direction and away from the idea that body cameras and sentencing reform are going to save us.
Right. So if you were advising Bernie, what would you tell him to do?
I think he's got to embrace this idea of rethinking what public safety is, that public safety is having strong communities, building up individuals, moving away from trying to criminalize our way out of all of our social problems. And the thing is, I know that he agrees with all that.
Yeah. I don't think it's, I mean,
but he's not articulating it.
Yeah, I don't think it's the lowest common denominator. I think maybe he's just like, hasn't gotten it together enough yet.
Well, I can't figure out who's advising him on criminal justice policy, and I've tried to ask around.
Yeah,
and we know the kind of people advising him on economic policy and and other things. And you know, one of the big electoral challenges for him is, I think, you know, reaching out to African American voters, especially older African American voters. He's made huge inroads with young ones, and my own students included You know, 2 years ago, my students were very sympathetic to Bernie, unlike their parents.
Right.
But I think he does need to take a better position. I think he can, consistent with his overall framework, but I just haven't seen it articulated.
Yeah.
So give me a call.
Yeah, Bernie or Bree. Bree's his press secretary. She's been on the show. And what about the incarceration enfranchisement discussion that, again, we had, I guess it was asked by the CNN during their marathon debate, you know, like town halls with different Dems, they asked about whether people in jail should have the right to vote. And they, of course, did that Dukakis move where they choose like an extreme example, like the Boston marathon bomber. Can you talk about that?
So, I mean, it's great that people are having this conversation. It's great that Bernie and some others have made a clear statement in favor of extending the franchise. But this is not a core issue, I don't think. It's a symbolic issue. The population that's in prisons and jails is going to be a very low voter participation population, frankly. And while I'm all in favor of this, this is not criminal justice reform, and this is not going to get us out of mass incarceration. Restoring rights to folks with past felonies is more important. It's a much larger population. So, you know, we see that happening in Florida and other places. So that, I think, could really change the dynamics of elections in a place like Florida, which is why they're trying to dial it back, the Republican legislature. But I want more talk about how we can take problems away from the police and actually solve them in positive ways.
Right.
To me, that's the real litmus test.
And what about, really quickly, the Florida initiative where they included, so it was giving the vote to felons, ex-felons, but excluding murderers and sex offenders?
You know, this was the compromise that got worked out, and it was controversial within the advocacy community, and, you know, some people even voted against it because it wasn't as inclusive. You know, it's not my job to sit here and micro-analyze the decision-making among good people of good faith trying to make something really important happen. It's disappointing. But I see the incredible political pressure that they were under to try to cobble together a majority, which they did.
Right.
You know, so you especially don't want to second guess people who achieved an amazing, important victory. And maybe as other states take on this issue, we can make more progress and try to frame things in an even better way.
Yeah. So it doesn't carve out people who... Because I guess it was somewhat historic because it was the first state constitutional amendment that excluded some people. It's interesting because I asked Alicia Experi about this. She brought it up, actually, and your responses are very different. I kind of tend more towards yours where I was like...
She wasn't having it.
No. And she thought the organizers weren't politically, like, weren't looking at power enough. Anyway, it's interesting. We could have a debate. Well, thank you. This is great.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah. Speaking of Alice Speri, don't forget to become Patreon members so you can hear my related but also very different conversation with Alice Speri, criminal justice reporter at The Intercept. Go to patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please follow Craig on Instagram and Twitter at BBOFlock. That's B as in boy, B as in boy, O flock, FLOCK. Follow Alex on Twitter at avitali. Keep up with the work that they're doing at policingandjustice.org. As always, you can rate and review The Katie Halper Show on iTunes. And The Katie Halper Show theme song is by the band Cordova. The show is edited by Ted Reedy.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.